are relevant to notaries. I'm doing a similar thing today. As Andre said at the beginning of his talk this morning, today is not so much about giving you any answers, more about looking at the sorts of questions that will come up over the year. And my presentation is very much along those lines. Notaries face all sorts of different questions which relate to private international law, and I'm going to look at some of those with you just to give you some sort of context as to why you're studying this course at all and how it will be relevant when you all hopefully qualify as notaries at the end of year two. I would like to just go over some of the points that Jane made and also that Andre made generally about the course and standards and how to deal with exams, books, that sort of thing. You can pretty much take it if you've been told something three times in a day, it's probably important, so I'll make no apology for going over some of the same old ground. It's just fairly depressing for me and for the tutors on year two when you start reading someone's assignment and you see a typo in line two and you think, well, yeah, we're all fallible. We all have the odd slip. There's the typo for this assignment, and hopefully there won't be any more. And you get to line four, and there's another one. And you get to line six, and there's another one. And the answer's actually okay. And the subject's been understood. The question has been answered. It's just a general carelessness, which in a discursive answer is irritating. But when we look in terms of notarial practice and the ability of a person to draft accurately, it's actually quite worrying. And that sort of slip in a notarial act can be fatal. We will treat it as such. If you are drafting a notarial act as part of your answer for year two, that sort of slip, a comma in the wrong place, a semicolon where it shouldn't be, spelling something incorrectly, using a homonym which has a completely different meaning. These things can take us all by surprise. I'm as fallible as everybody else, but you really must get into the habit of trying to be accurate whenever you can. I don't want this to be too much of a stick to beat you with. We go on about it a lot. I'd like it to be a carrot. I'd like you all to really take an interest in language, in the English language, to want to be able to write accurately and correctly. As well as studying the topics that we provide you with on this course, it's a really good idea to pick up a grammar book from time to time. They're available at very little cost. Even the simplest grammar book can remind you of something that you thought you knew and had perhaps forgotten, or correct you on something that you'd misunderstood a while back. It doesn't take a great deal of time. It really is worth the effort. And once you start to take an interest and enjoy language, you'll find that the errors start to drop off all by themselves. Remember that before you get your faculty, you have to persuade the Archbishop of Canterbury to describe you as a literate person. Take that on board. On the subject of books, now this is really a pointer for year two as opposed to how it works for year one. In year two, you're allowed set texts in the examination room, and the set texts contain notarial precedents, which are texts devised by the authors to assist notaries in drafting notarial acts. They are not compulsory forms, they are not statutory forms, they are wording which, in the opinion of the editors of the respective texts, are good starting points. Now, the editor may or may not be right in that opinion. The choice of which wording you use in a notarial act is down to you. One of the joys of notarial practice is that there are very few statutory fixed forms. If you enjoy drafting, this is a wonderful profession to be in. If you don't like drafting and you'd rather fill out forms, well, it's probably not the right profession for you. What we have found, and particularly at the most recent practical weekend, was that those students who had the confidence, the self-confidence, to write their own notarial acts in language which they felt comfortable with without using the precedents in the set texts, wrote far more coherent and simply comprehensible notarial acts than those who turned to the back of Brooks Notary opened up the general notary and tried to copy out and amend a text that was pre-prepared. We found that in a sense, a little bit surprising, because we'd never treated the exercises in that way before, but I think it's very instructive. If you trust yourself and if you are aware of your own limitations, because we all have them, in language, and you write using language with which you are comfortable, you are far less likely to make mistakes. And that is of crucial importance when drafting notarial acts. So I make that point now, in the hope that it will stay with you for next year. Let's move on to what we're all here for. Notaries and private international law. Well, this course is presented to you as a course for notaries, as opposed to a general private international law course. Now, why should that be? What's so special about notaries? We also present it as an introduction. Why is it an introduction? Why isn't it the whole thing? What's left at the end? Well, let's take the first point. Notaries are different in so many ways from other lawyers. Everything that a notary does will have an international dimension of one sort or another. Notaries are constantly encountering situations involving two, maybe three, or more legal systems. Now, this is not something that can be said of most legal practitioners. There are, of course, lawyers who specialise in matters of private international law, advising on international finance transactions, representing them in international litigation, dealing with complex matrimonial and family situations. And again, the notary is different from that type of lawyer. Those specialised lawyers spend long periods with their clients, advising on all aspects of the transaction, thrashing out deals, preparing for litigation. And the notary simply doesn't have that extended contact with clients. The notary is acting as a public certifying officer. The notary will be brought in to deal with certain aspects of a transaction. The notary will not see all of it. It's often the case that only a particular document out of a number of documents requires the notary's attention. So the notary's view of private international law is particular to the profession. Let's look at the situations where a notary will become involved. Documents have a life cycle. And the notary may be there at the beginning, partway through the document's life, at an early stage, at a late stage, and the notary may also be there at the end. Now, lawyer speak being rather perverse, the birth of a document begins with an execution. There may, of course, be a delivery in the case of a deed under English law. And one of the questions that will come up at an early stage is which law governs the birth of the document. Some documents are very short-lived. Some can last for a much longer time. Documents may serve a simple, straightforward purpose in one place, or they may be documents that have to be valid in all sorts of different places and be used for all sorts of different purposes. The life of a document will come to an end in one way or another. Its life may be restricted from the beginning. It may simply expire. It may have been destined to last for a longer period, but have its life cut short. Or everything might go very badly wrong, and you end up with a court case with different parties fighting over their rights under that document. So when the notary is called in to the large meeting room with multinational corporations and their legal advisors, banks providing as a consortium millions or billions of dollars in finance. These are the sorts of parties that have had long, lengthy periods of advice from legal advisors who are experts in the private international law aspects. The notary may be involved in a large number of the documents involved, may only be just the one, as I said earlier. But the notary in that situation is in a rather privileged position because the advice on the private international law aspects has already been given by experts in the field. And this doesn't always apply. In fact, for most notaries, that type of transaction where the expert advice is ready on tap will be almost unheard of. In the majority of cases, the notary's client will have had some advice, but that advice has come from a lawyer in another jurisdiction. This lawyer is not an expert in private international law matters. That lawyer is an expert in French law, if the transaction is happening in France, German law, Russian law. It is advice on the foreign law. It is not advice on the private international law aspects. And some clients, indeed, have had no advice at all before they come to see the notary. So the type of instruction that can come in will vary depending on circumstances. The questions that the notary will ask are, put very briefly, these. Is this something that I can do, or should I say no? And that is perhaps the most crucial question of all. Once you commit yourself to acting for a client, you have to be prepared to follow through on that. There will be circumstances where you simply have to say no. This is not something that I can deal with. And then maybe many reasons for that. That's something that we would look at in year two. If you are agreeing to act, you need to be able to establish at a very early stage on what basis you are prepared to act so that you can advise your client on what needs to happen if you are to act as a notary. Your client will want to know whether you can do it straight away. It's generally what they're looking for. But there may be circumstances where you have to say, well, yes, I can act, but I cannot do it straight away because certain things need to happen before I'm in a position to act. So you need to be able to analyse what must happen. If I'm to deal with this, what are the steps that must be taken before I can complete the notarial act that is required? Examples are coming. When making these decisions, the private international law aspects of the transaction are of central importance. The first step in reaching a decision about those questions will be to understand what is going on, which I suppose is one of those banal points, but one that needs to be made. The first thing the notary will want to do is to look at the client's general situation and try to work out whether it makes sense. Does the notary know what's going on in general terms? What is the client's situation? What is the client's goal? Does the client actually understand the situation? Because that cannot be taken for granted. Clients can often be misled, misguided, or simply ignorant of important aspects of a transaction. To give a common example, perhaps the client simply wants to purchase a house, a villa, a flat in Spain. The client comes to you, say, right, I'm signing here, you sign there. You say, well, hold on, what's actually going on? I say, oh, well, I'm told I have to sign this if I'm going to buy the house. So you look at the document, say, well, it doesn't actually say which house you're going to buy. So have you actually chosen the property? Oh, yes, I know exactly which one I'm going to buy. Have you decided what you're going to pay for it? Oh, yes, that's all sorted out. But it may not be shown in the document. The document may be a very general power of attorney. It may go well beyond what is required for the purchase of the property. The client's belief is that the document is the thing that needs to be signed in order to get the house. In reality, it is much more than that, and it would be dangerous for the notary to permit the client to sign that document without giving proper advice as to exactly what is going on. And that runs into the meaning of the specific document to be authenticated as well. You need to understand the general situation and the particular relevance of the document that you are asked to authenticate. And this is where it starts to tie in with what Andre was saying earlier today. When you're understanding the particular document, jurisdiction is something that should be present in your mind. When you look through the document, is there actually a jurisdiction clause there? Jurisdiction really is something that's far too easy to ignore at the early stage of a transaction. Clients do tend to be optimistic. They believe that everything will go according to plan, and they don't like to think about what might happen if it all goes wrong. And of course, things do go wrong. And when things do go wrong, clients can get some nasty surprises. And when it does all go wrong, the notary is potentially in the firing line unless he or she can show that the proper steps were taken to advise the client whilst facilitating the transaction in question. Now, for example, it may be that the client, he, she, or it, simply did not realise that by signing the document, he, she, or it might get sued in Bogota or Bishkek instead of in London. It might be that the client didn't realise that damages under the law of Mongolia are three times what they would have been under English law. That sort of situation is a nasty surprise to the client. And as a notary, you would not want to be in the position of being having a finger pointed at you saying, well, I signed this under your guidance and you did not tell me that this would be the case. So you're looking for your jurisdiction clause. And these are the questions which today have no answers. Is there a jurisdiction clause there? If there is one, is it valid? Would it actually be enforceable? Which law governs the validity of the jurisdiction clause? And what if there is no jurisdiction clause? In which jurisdictions will or might the courts take a case if it were to come to litigation. So those are our open questions for now. As it happens, clients who get themselves sued in Ecuador or Uzbekistan, anywhere outside of the UK, are actually tremendously good business for notaries. If that party is being sued in the English courts, what work would there be for a notary to do? Absolutely nothing. English courts, not interested at the moment. You may be aware of Civil Procedure Rule 3220. If you're not, you will be by the end of year two. Civil Procedure Rule 3220 provides for a form of probative status for notarial acts, the idea being that a notarial act would become a form of evidence used in the English courts. As far as the profession is aware, this rule has lain entirely dormant after years of wrangling to have it put into the CPR. We have no knowledge of it being used at all. So that, of course, may change. But at present, for an English court case, the notary is entirely redundant. But a foreign court case is a prime source of business. So typically my insurance clients are completely ignorant of jurisdiction clauses, sign up to all sorts of things, and then express mild surprise, mild because they're getting used to it, when they get sued in all sorts of places around the world. And of course they have to defend the action as a condition of the reinsurance contract. So I think they just come to me and they have to execute powers of attorney, provide witness statements, swear affidavits, generally good notarial business. So as long as it's not my fault, I'm generally quite happy for people to get sued in foreign countries. If we move on to choice of law, remembering to keep these two concepts entirely distinct in your minds, is there a choice of law clause in the document? If there is one, is it actually enforceable? And how can you tell whether it's enforceable or not? Which law governs the validity of the choice of law clause? And again, if there isn't one, what are the options? What are the possibilities? Is it a situation in which you can tell or make an educated guess as to what law will apply? Or is it a situation where it's been, in effect, left to chance by the parties? These are the questions that we want to ask. The position of the notary in practice will be that all these questions are present in the notary's mind, but the notary is well aware that he or she cannot have all the answers. The questions may indeed have no answer at that stage, but the important thing is to be aware of the issues and to know who to ask if you do not know the answer to the question. It may be a question that can properly be answered by a lawyer in the jurisdiction in which the transaction is taking place, a lawyer in the jurisdiction where the company is incorporated. If you're aware of the issues and you know which questions to ask, you should not go too far wrong. As a notary, I've written your goal, but that's perhaps not strong enough. Your obligation is to establish that your client has been through a proper decision-making process. And that's how I would summarise how we look at the PIL questions. Now, at this point, you haven't actually done anything. All you've done is look at the client's instructions, the client's documents, and ask some questions. What happens when you actually get going? You have a document in front of you, and it needs to be executed. The primary question is which law applies to the formalities for execution. This is a pre-birth question. The document has not been born yet. It doesn't exist. It doesn't have an independent life. It can't be litigated. No law can apply to it. It is a fetal document. You are bringing it into existence. You are the midwife. Which laws apply, or which law applies? Is there only one law, or are there several? When looking at the applicable law for execution of a document, there are three main possibilities. It may be that English law applies to the exclusion of all other legal systems. This is commonly referred to as the locus regit actum principle. Nice bit of Latin for you. It's not like the lex so-and-so bits of Latin that you'll come across in the rest of the PIL course. It's a phrase which means the place governs the act, i.e., because it's being executed in England, English law applies. That's only one possibility. Second possibility is that the law of the receiving jurisdiction may apply to the exclusion of all others. And the third possibility is that the law of the receiving jurisdiction applies plus some elements of other legal systems which may or may not include English law. So three options. One is English law, the other one is the law of the receiving jurisdiction, and the third most likely possibility is law of the receiving jurisdiction plus elements of other systems. The other option which I put on there is, what about the law of the jurisdiction in which litigation might take place? If that is not the place of execution of the document or the place where it is to be used, are there further jurisdictions whose requirements need to be taken into consideration? Let's give you some examples. The locus regit actum principle is perhaps most commonly applied in notarial practice. The most common situation for a notary is that compliance with local law is required in the notarial act. Now, in theory, of course, this is the simplest situation for the notary because you are all English lawyers, and you are all familiar with English law. If a document is being executed in front of you in accordance with English law, or a deed is being executed and delivered in front of you under English law, you should be in a position to confirm that that has been done correctly. Examples of the second situation, where English law is of no application, well, most documents for the United States would represent examples of this category. The English rule, for example, on attestation of deeds is of no application whatsoever. The different states in the USA will have different requirements. Some states may require deeds to be sealed. Some will require attestation by two witnesses. Some may require one witness. There are different documents with different requirements in different states. The point about dealing with documents from the USA is that you need to comply with the law of that state. No one is interested in English law for the formalities of the execution. If we take powers of attorney for use in India, which is a common notarial function in this country, well, Indian law requires two witnesses. One witness is no good. They're not interested in compliance with English law, they're interested in compliance with Indian law. In addition to the two witnesses, a notary must attest the execution of the power of attorney. For evidentiary purposes, you'll also be certifying a photograph of the grantor of the power of attorney, and maybe even taking a thumbprint. These are not matters which are required for the document to be valid, but they are requirements which enable the document to be registered and proved. If we take Caribbean jurisdictions, specifically the Bahamas, all deeds for use in the Bahamas must be executed under seal. English attestation, not acceptable. They're not interested. If it's not done under seal, it will not be accepted. Which raises an interesting question, since we're on private international law. And those of you who dealt with deeds regularly before 1989 may have a box of little red seals tucked away in the office somewhere. Well, if you've still got them, you'll be getting them out when you start your practice as a notary. If you don't know what I'm talking about, you soon will, because we get you to use them at the practical weekend. An English company, even though it's not required to have a seal, can always adopt a common seal. What do you do if your client is a Dutch company? Dutch law doesn't recognise the validity of seals. Dutch companies cannot have seals. What happens if your client, the Dutch company, needs to execute a deed for use in the Bahamas? An open question. Let's see where this can take us. Oh, sorry, on number three, the third option, the requirements of the foreign jurisdiction plus another. The main example here is where the document is to be used in a civil law jurisdiction, the sort of jurisdiction which derives its law from the Roman law that you've been studying in the first part of this year. Their notaries will use a particular form of notarial act. We call it the public form notarial act. They simply think of it as a notarial act. There is no other type. The law of that country may require certain documents, wherever they are executed in the world, to be executed in this particular notarial form. And it's not a question of evidence, it's a question of validity. Within that form, the notary will be required to confirm due execution and the binding nature of the transaction under local law. So here you have a combination of a prescribed form for the notarial act on which the validity depends, but within that, you are also ensuring compliance with the law of England and Wales. So there you have a mixture of the law of two distinct jurisdictions. Let's take a document being executed before a notary in this country, and it relates to a transaction in Mexico. The parties are Irish, Italian, and South African companies. You've got five jurisdictions to take into consideration. The receiving jurisdiction, which is Mexico, which is a civil law jurisdiction. England and Wales, the place where the document is being executed, and then companies incorporated in three different places. The Mexican requirement will be for this public form notarial act and for the notary to confirm due execution in accordance with the law of England and Wales as the place where the document is executed. So the notary will turn to the Overseas Companies Execution of Documents and Registration of Charges Regulations 2009, with which you are all familiar. This is the bit of English private international law which deals with the execution of documents by foreign companies, and it simply refers the formalities for execution to the place of incorporation. So the notary dealing with this situation will have to research Irish, Italian, and South African law if the notary is to be in a position to provide the notarial act that's required in Mexico. And this is where we go back to the initial decision, do I act? Faced with this situation, is this something that I'm going to be able to do? Can I research the laws of these three jurisdictions, or is that something which I simply cannot do? So when you agree to act, you have to understand what you're actually taking on. And in this sort of situation, you're taking on an awful lot. So we finally got the document executed. Pen has been put to paper. Seal may have been affixed. Witnesses may have attested signatures. Photographs attached to the document. Fingerprints stuck on. The document is executed. The notary's function is to authenticate the execution of that document. But how? There's no one way of doing this. Here the English notary really is in an almost unique position. Notaries in most countries have one way of doing things. They're trained to do it in that particular way. That's the it is the manner in which the document must be authenticated under their local law. Now, who can tell me the requirements of English law for the notarial authentication of a document? No hands going up. There aren't any. English law simply ignores the existence of notaries unless you happen to be protesting a bill of exchange. And even then, there are provisions for what happens if you can't find a notary. So the notary needs to be aware of what is expected or what is required in the receiving jurisdiction. Or receiving jurisdictions. What if the document is going to be used in more than one place? Having found out how it needs to be done to be accepted in that jurisdiction or in those jurisdictions, you need to work out whether it's something that you can actually do in this country. One of the things that you'll be learning about at quite a late stage in this course is the Authentic Act and the recognition and enforcement of authentic acts under the European PIL regime. Now, it may be that in the receiving jurisdiction, an authentic act would be produced by the notary. Well, when you learn about authentic acts, and when you study on year two, you'll realise that English notaries simply cannot produce that. We don't have the authority to create an enforceable document. We can create a document which is probative, but not a document that can be enforced as if it were a judgment handed down by a court. So, if we can't do exactly the same thing, can we do something which is equivalent, something that will be close enough to be accepted? If your document is going to more than one jurisdiction, can you produce one notarial act that will be accepted in all of them, or are you going to have to produce more than one? A reasonably common situation is that the same thing is being done. Let's say there's litigation in Mexico and in the United States. The document that works for the United States will not work for Mexico, and vice versa. They have two completely different forms of authentication, and you cannot mix and match those requirements. So you will have to do separate documents, one for Mexico and one for the United States. If you're dealing with two civil law jurisdictions, whilst they may differ slightly in their requirements, a French notarial act is different in form to a Spanish notarial act, they are sufficiently similar in nature that you may be able to produce one English notarial act that is acceptable in both. These are questions to be asked. Do think about all the possible jurisdictions that may be relevant. It's simple enough to identify the receiving jurisdiction or jurisdictions for a document, but that's not necessarily the end of the story. And Andre brought up some of these matters in his talk earlier on, where I hear refer to the personal law of the party. Well, there are connecting factors that may influence where a document becomes relevant. Maybe the party's nationality, maybe the party's residence, it may be domicile in one of the using one of the definitions that we have looked at that were mentioned earlier today. For a company, the place of incorporation of a company or another body corporate is an obvious jurisdiction to be taken into consideration. Litigation, again, where may this document be litigated? Is the notarial act in a form that would be acceptable to a court in that jurisdiction? Having now authenticated the document, the job is not quite done in many cases. Is there anything else you need to do? And we're looking at the law of the receiving jurisdiction specifically here. What are the requirements? Will they simply accept that I am a notary? If my notarial act is going to Australia or New Zealand or South Africa, most Commonwealth countries, they will look at my signature and seal and they will assume that I am a notary because I say I am. I do not get the same courtesy in many countries around the world. If my document is going to France or Spain or Russia or Mexico, we've mentioned Japan, for example, they're going to ask for something else. What they will ask for is confirmation from my government that I am a notary. And this is the apostille. André mentioned the Hague Conventions earlier. Well, the apostille is a process under a Hague Convention, which requires parties to the convention to recognise this form of verification of a public document. This is public document with an autonomous definition under the convention. In the same way that domicile was found to have two meanings earlier on, public document has two meanings. It has an English law meaning and it has a Hague Convention meaning. For non-parties to the convention, the apostille isn't enough. They want something else as well. They want a representative of their own government. So the diplomatic representation in this country of Kyrgyzstan, Saudi Arabia, Brazil. They want something from their own government that they will recognise before they recognise the UK government stamp, before they recognise the notary's signature and seal. There are other requirements as well. Some documents have to go through a Chamber of Commerce. So these are all the questions, these are all the consequences of the private international law aspects of notarial practice. Going back to my second point right at the beginning, why is this an introductory course? Well, English private international law is only the beginning. As André has said, and I imagine Jonathan may well say the same thing to you, just to drive it home, English private international law is English law. French PIL is different. Australian PIL is different. As a notary, you are dealing with transactions which are based in another jurisdiction. You will be coming up against these foreign systems of private international law all the time. So understanding English private international law is essential, but it is only the beginning. We're now going to take a 5-minute break before the next lecture starts. Between the end of Jonathan's next lecture and the question and answer session at the end, there will be tea and coffee available then.